singing. I love some of those. That last one is one of my favorites, and good selection of singing some old, some new, some toe-tapping ones. And speaking of songs, I thought I'd start with the songs. Any fans of the 1960s? Okay. Anybody like the music of the 1960s? Anybody do you remember the question, how many people here actually remember being in the 60s? I like that joke that says, if you remember the 60s, you probably weren't there. But what would the 1960s be without just an angry protest song? Can I recite an angry protest song from the 60s? This is Masters of War by Bob Dylan from 1963. Some of you may know this one, but it's, when you think of an angry protest song, this one's got to be top of the list. Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks. I just want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes and you turn and run further when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won, you want me to believe? But I see through your eyes and I see through your brain like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. Then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansions while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. Now listen to this verse. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled, fear to bring children into the world. For threatening my baby unborn and unnamed, you ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know to talk at a turn? You may say that I'm young. You might say I am unlearned, but there's one thing I know, that though I'm younger than you, that even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And then finally, here's the last, probably most scathing, and we could quite literally say, put the nail in the coffin on this protest song. And I hope that you die and your death will come soon. I'll follow your casket by the pale afternoon. And I'll watch while you're lowered down in your deathbed. And I'll stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead. Wow. Aren't everybody glad you came to church this morning? Feeling good? Don't you love you have this just bright up singing songs about joy, and then I just come ruin everything by an angry 1960s protest song. That is, again, written in 1963 by Bob Dylan, and it's kind of unique that that was written actually 2 years before the U.S. entered into the Vietnam conflict. But if you were to break down that song in just one simple word, some of the words that came to my mind is just retribution. Maybe the politically correct word for it might be justice. Another way of putting it is the word payback. Right, what's the basic message of the song? Right? Bob Dylan is looking at these people who are building these guns and these warplanes and these bombs and these tanks, these incredible instruments of war and violence, selling them to both sides, and people, you know, right? Many people are dying in the conflict, but the people who are profiting on it never have to experience the death, the terror, the horror of war. Right? So what is Bob Dylan saying? For justice to be done, the people who are profiting, who can sit safely behind in their homes and in their offices, they need to experience the terror that war brings. That's the only way that justice can be true. And it's kind of unique that often, if you remember back when Bob Dylan was in the 60s, he was often referenced as a prophet of his time, kind of referenced to this old type, Old Testament prophet because of just kind of the way and the vivid language that he would use to speak to our culture. And when I was thinking of Joel, and as we're wrapping up this book of Joel, you're going to see some of the similar themes in this final chapter. And it's a little bit similar to what Bob Dylan has, but a little bit different, but you kind of understand and see some of the similarities. We're wrapping up to today this series, which again is probably really not that for the faint of heart. It's a pretty powerful book. This little book, just three chapters long, found at the end of the Old Testament by the prophet Joel. The theme of this book really is that same theme that we're using for this short series called The Day of the Lord. And the Day of the Lord is just a simple way of when God, in two ways for Joel and often in the Old Testament prophets, is intervenes in the works of history to bring justice to the evil and the hurting that has been done by humanity in this world, specifically for Israel. But it also points to this really final day of reckoning, final day where God will return and deal with all the evil and injustice of the world once and for all. I like, I've mentioned this, how Pastor Dan introduced this series a number of weeks ago, saying that it's both a day of despair and a day of hope, or a day that begins with despair and ends with hope. And I'm just going to give a little bit kudos. We got April here, and out of all, she does all the graphics, and I just love her Joel graphics, because you kind of have the despair on one side and the hope on the other side. So really brings both of those in. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at a passage where, again, it was that heavy on the despair, where Joel really uses the vivid imagination to get the reader in or the listener in to be scared, but be scared to prepare to this place of who can stand before the Lord on that great and incredible day. But then the next week we looked at this idea of the hope, right? He said there is a rescue. It's calling out on the name of the Lord. Everyone who calls out on the name of the Lord will be saved. And in fact, again, when Joel wrote that, that was for the people of Israel, but on that opening day of the church, it was Peter who used Joel 2, this little book, to use that for all nations, that this deliverance that comes from Zion was no other than Jesus Christ, who gave his life on the cross, and that everyone, not just for the people of Israel, but of all nations, if they call out on his name, will be saved. Well, we're going to look at this final chapter of Joel, and we're going to see God reveals himself in three distinct ways. Some kind of are heavy on the despair. One really leads to hope. So the first way God reveals himself is God, or Yahweh, the God of Israel, as judge. And not just any judge, the perfect judge. But I want you to, before we get, and we get this image of God as the judge, Joel 3 begins with these words, "In those days and at that time when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem." Right? He's going to talk about some heavy stuff, but before that, he introduces this idea, these days are going to be dark for some, but they're going to bring about blessing for my people. And I just want you to hold that first line verse, because the book ends up revisiting what that means, in those days and at that time when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. Verse 2 says, "I will gather all nations and I will bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat." Now, where is the valley of Jehoshaphat? If you remember some of your kings of Israel and Judah, one of the kings of Judah's name was Jumpin' Jehoshaphat. It was Jehoshaphat, right? I always loved that name. I always kind of liked that expression. Now, we could say, now if you know anything about your history, Jehoshaphat had this tremendous victory. You read about it in 2 Chronicles, where there's this great battle, and he has this great victory, but he didn't have to lift a finger. He just had to show up because the enemies that were coming against him, they turned on themselves, destroyed themselves, and they just had to reap the rewards. But my guess is this is not talking about that valley where that famous battle for King Jehoshaphat was held, but specifically the term and the name Jehoshaphat means the Lord judges, right? So this is taking place in the place where the Lord will judge the nations of the world. Listen to what it says this, "There I will enter into judgment against them concerning my inheritance, my people Israel, for they scattered my people among the nations and divided up my land." So the main area in which he wants to bring a verdict to or bring judgment to is just the treatment that these other nations and surrounding nations have had against his people. And verse 3, again, this is sort of one of the most brutal verses in all of Joel. Listen to what it says. "They cast lots for my people and traded boys for prostitutes. They sold girls for wine that they may drink." What's he saying? I'm coming into judgment to bring against these people who saw life so valueless. Right? My people, my children, they were of so little value, they traded them together just like kids would trade, you know, collecting cards, you know, baseball cards or something like that. He said, "We don't even really care what this is worth. Just give me a quick hit with that girl or with one of those wines, just a quick little pleasure." They were that valueless, that meaningless. And then Joel says this, "Now what have you against me, O Tyre and Sidon, and you regions of Philistia?" Basically saying, what did I ever do to you? Why did you do this? And he says, "Are you repaying me for something I've done?" I mean, we didn't do anything to you. We didn't do anything to deserve this. And he goes, "But if you are paying me back, I will swiftly and speedily return on your own heads what you have done. For you took my silver and my gold and carried off my finest treasures to your temples. You sold the people of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks that you might send them far from their homeland." And then listen to this, verse 7. "Go, see, I'm rousing them out of the places in which you sent them. And I will return on your own heads what you have done. I will sell your sons and daughters to the people of Judah, and they will sell them to the Sabians. The Lord has spoken." Now, what's kind of the main issue that God's or Joel's referring to here? It looks like human slavery. There's a bunch of everything, but it's narrowed down into this human slavery. And then you can look at it and says, okay, just what you did to my people, I'm going to do back to your people. And you can look at it and go, I don't like the sound of this, right? That doesn't sound nice. And sometimes people say, is God advocating for slavery? Absolutely not, right? In fact, I would love to do a message on slavery at some point, because I think sometimes people have a false view of what the Bible teaches and doesn't teach. What Joel is saying here and what God is saying here is retribution, right? I'm just paying back exactly what you did to my people back to you, right? See how you like it. Maybe think about it this way, and maybe every parent has had this experience. Now, you remember when your kids were young and they did something and you were about to get them in trouble because, you know, whatever they, you know, whatever rule they broke, whatever thing that they broke in your house, whatever, you know, younger sibling that they broke, whatever it is that got them in trouble, and they come and it's your turn to give them the discipline, what's the one thing that kid says, you know, when you're about to ground them, spank them, whatever it was that you did? "It's not fair." Did you ever have that? I don't know what that reaction is. Now, I remember as a kid always saying to my parents, "It's not fair," whenever I got in trouble. But when you become a parent and it is your kid telling you that it's not fair, you have a whole different reaction. In that situation, my reaction is this: are you kidding me? Not fair? You want fair? You don't want fair, right? I have told you 100 times not to play with the ball in the living room, and you just broke this priceless $1,000 family heirloom that's been in the family for 3 generations, and I'm taking your $5 allowance away for 2 weeks, and you're saying that's not fair? You want fair, kid? You do not want fair, right? You just broke one of your sister's toys over her head. Do you want me to break something over your head? Do you want fair? No, you do not want fair. Right? Do you get the point? But what God is doing is saying an equal, right? And again, the foundation of justice in the Bible is based on fairness. And if we're honest, we don't like fairness. We might like it for others, but we don't like it for ourselves. A number of times I've talked about when we've talked about God, and I've referenced lots of verses, but often when God is referenced as a judge, similar to Joel, what he's saying here, right? It's one for one, right? That's what he's saying. But he's saying that God will judge in truth, in righteousness, with equity, right? That's just another word for fairness, right? With perfect, right? God never does anything that's unfair. But again, listen to some of these foundational verses in Scripture that speak about how judgment should work. Again, going back to Genesis 9, verse 6, we read these words, "Whoever shed the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made man." That's right, right? So kind of one for one, right? This is why we don't mess. This is why we won't murder. If you want to murder, then you have to pay with it for your own life. One for one. Or there's this, what's called the Lex Talionis. Again, this was the foundation of the law in Exodus, right? Exodus 21. "But if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise." Right? It's hard to argue with that. Or it's like one to one. Right? Again, it's called this, literally called Lex Talionis, or the law of retribution, or most more literally, the law of similar nature, right? So it's one for one. And you could say, well, that's Old Testament. Didn't Jesus say, "You've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I say unto you, you know, if you get struck in one cheek, give him the other cheek. If it says walk 1 mile, go 2 miles," and he says, yes, absolutely. Jesus said that, right? Because we don't like fairness. You want to offer and respond with grace. But remember what he said shortly right after that. "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." Right? Measure for measure. Right? Reap what we sow. And this is the issue with the Bible that sometimes people we don't get. Right? The judgment is eternal fairness. Right? It's reaping what we sow. One of the descriptions of hell is, again, it's this place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. Right? That's one of the most used pictures. It's used in these vivid imageries. But it's a place of sorrow, regret, and I would also say pride. Right? But it's a picture of receiving eternal fairness. And with God, there's either grace and mercy, or there's fairness. And that's why God says, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. What was that first song that, again, I introduced by Bob Dylan, right? It was a call for justice, at least as he saw it, for fairness. They need to receive and experience what they've caused and suffer others' peoples to suffer, one for one. But we're going to see, that's one picture of the Bible, but it also adds another element. And let me just make a real quick aside. Sometimes we look at this and we say this is kind of a fandangled Christian idea. But in fact, most religions offer this way. Even Eastern religions, right? If you're Buddhist, Hindus, views that follow the idea of reincarnation. What's your next life conditional on? How well you lived in this life, right? It's exactly proportional. And here's the reality. 99, if you really follow it, people sometimes have romantic views of it, but it's actually a picture, most people who understand it really, it's a picture of hell, right? Because 99.9% of the time, you're going to regress and rather than progress into the next life when you have to try to pay it back, right? It's this, again, this idea of fairness. But when we really, really think about it, it's a little bit scarier than we can imagine. So the first picture is this picture of God as the judge. The second picture is God the Avenger. Probably and arguably the most successful movie franchise of the last 20 years have been all those Marvel superhero movies. They call it the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but out of all those superhero movies, the most popular, most grossing by far are the ones called the Avengers, when they just bring all these superheroes together in kind of one kind of major showdown, and they call them again the Avengers. And what's the role of the Avenger? Right? Not just to save the day, save the poor helpless civilian, save planet Earth or whatever it is from the back of, but to actually rid the world of the evil, get rid of the threat from its roots. And again, this is this picture that we get of God here in Joel. Proclaim this among the nations, prepare for war, rouse the warriors, let all the fighting men draw near and attack. Right, God is basically beckoning and egging on the enemies of God to come forward. Perhaps he's calling their bluff. And one of the things that, again, this biblical picture has, that not only does God call, but most oftentimes that these nations, these enemies of God, willfully come and bring the attack to God themselves. And then listen to what he says next. He says, beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Here, Joel reverse quotes Isaiah and Micah. So in Isaiah and Micah, you've got this great line, and it's often repeated. It's very familiar, and it's God speaking to the people of Israel. Take those implements of war and turn them into implements and tools for farming, right? Because you don't need to use them for war. It's going to be a time of peace. But here it's the opposite. Take those implements of farming, those peaceful tools, and turn them into weapons, because you're going to need them, right? This is not one of those things we sing when the weak say, I am strong, and the poor say, I am rich. It's what the Lord has done in me. This is God saying to those, because you're even going to need the weaklings among you, so you better give them some strength, right? He says, come quickly, all you nations from every side, and assemble there. Bring down your warriors, O Lord. Let the nations be roused. Let them advance in the valley of Jehoshaphat. For I will sit to judge the nations on every side. Swing the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come trample the grapes, for the winepress is full and the vats overflow. So great is their wickedness. Right? Again, it's this idea that the picture of the sin of mankind has reached to the top of the container, and it's overflowing overside, and it must be dealt with. Multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. So we've gone from the valley of the Lord judges to the valley of decision, which literally is the valley of the place where God will give out his verdict, his final verdict. The sun and moon will be darkened, and the stars no longer shine. The Lord will roar from Zion and thunder from Jerusalem. The earth and the sky will tremble. And again, it's this scary day, but then just as he finishes up, he reminds us, but not for everyone. But for the Lord will be a refuge for his people, a stronghold for the people of Israel. Remember how Joel 3 started? In those days and at that time when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, right? To do that is to deal with the enemies of God's people. I just want to pause, and again, I want to give a little bit of an aside. And I think this is important to think through. And Joel deals with this well. There are two major criticisms that I often hear and that you often hear that are very popular that are leveled against Christianity. And oftentimes they're from the same people, right? This is what they don't like about the Christian faith, the Christian religion. And often if they put those two thoughts together, they would realize that actually both of those views contradict themselves. The first one is this: I have a hard time believing in a loving God, and yet he could send somebody eternally who rejects him to a place of punishment, to hell. How is that possibly fair? And again, here's that picture of fairness, right? God will always judge unfairness, right? He's not going to measure outside, right? Again, I would say that picture of judgment, that picture of hell is eternal fairness, right? No one is going to come in that day and say, God, this wasn't fair.
right? I talked about this just kind of reference last week. Maybe it was in the second service, but I remember recently listening to a recent podcast where there was this one gentleman, he was an atheist, talking to a Christian, and he said, well, just God just knows me, right? So even if there is a God, he knows my heart, whatever, but so why does it matter? I just don't like this idea of God will hold it against me. If I'm like, you've got this life, you have no interest or concern of God or anything of God in this world, and yet you want God in the next life to force you to be with him for eternity. Right? No, he's actually giving you what you're asking for, what you want. Right? It's that eternal fairness. But the second reason why people really struggle with God is because he goes, well, if God is so loving, if God is so powerful, why does he allow such and such to happen? Right? And you could fill in the blank. Right? Why did he allow the Holocaust? Why does he allow all that evil exploitation of children that's happening in our world today? Why? Do you see the tension? Do you see the problem? Right? God gives the answer. Joel helps gives us the answer. He does deal with it. Right? Part of that answer is the day of the Lord, the time where there will be a reckoning for the injustices that are done. Maybe you can think of it this way. Maybe you've had this experience growing up and when you were a kid and you did something that was in trouble and your mom's there trying to deal with it, and you're like, I'm not listening to you, I don't want to buy this, and then your mom looks at you and says, well, we can deal with this now, or we can wait till your father gets home. Did anybody ever have that happen, right? Meaning, you probably want to deal with this now. But it's this picture, it's like you can deal with it now, or you can deal with it later. But one way or another, it's going to have to be dealt with. And again, think about that, just not, you know, there is something about us when we look for other people, when you know, nations invade other nations, when people abuse, you know, a child or something like that, you wish just God would just enact judgment right there and strike them down, right? Why doesn't he just do it right there and then? But the reality is, even if God acted that way, there's probably things and choices and ideas in our own life that we'd probably be zapped a whole bunch of times, even in any given day, if God was going to be truthful and honest to us, right? It's either now or it's later. And the day of the Lord says, no, I will deal with it. One of the things that I just maybe mention as an aside, but it's just a little simple aside, but oftentimes when we think even to just as evangelicals, we often focus on the individual nature of judgment and this and that. But if you notice, this is about nations, right? And as you read the Old Testament prophets, this is God's willing to kind of right all the wrongs of not just individuals, but of actually whole nations. When the prophets spoke, they usually spoke against complete nations and people. So first you have God, who is the judge. God, the avenger, comes back on a behalf. But that's not how Joel ends. God is finally given, revealed to us as the restorer and the sustainer. I'd also say this is a perfect picture of God as king, as Emmanuel, living in the presence of his people. But the Lord will be a refuge for his people, a stronghold for the people of Israel. So again, in this time of justice is also this time that brings hope for the people. I always think of, those pictures, if you see of back in World War II when the Allied forces finally got into Germany and they rescued a lot of the people from those concentration camps. Again, a lot of the people higher ups and left because they knew the role were getting in trouble, right? But you also hear those stories of some of those Allied forces when they saw the condition of those people and the children and the Jewish people, they were so angry they turned their vengeance upon some of the captors, right? Whether rightly or wrongly, they couldn't even fathom the injustice that was done. And then these people who were rescued, who had been suffered so much, right? Part of the way is just having these people saying, yes, the enemy is gone, there is nothing to fear. Follow me, we're going to protect you.
we're going to take you to safety. Right? One had to come at the expense of the other. Then verse 17, then you will know that I, the Lord your God, dwell in Zion, my holy hill. Jerusalem will be holy. Never again will foreigners invade her. In that day, the mountains will drip new wine and the hills flow with milk. All the ravines of Judah will run with water. A fountain will flow out of the Lord's house and will water the valley of Acacias. Right? Again, that Acacias live in places that are rough and rugged. It's kind of like the valley of the cactus. Right? These places that were dry and barren will be erupting with new life and blessing. But Egypt will be desolate, Edom a desert waste, because of a violence done to the people of Judah, in whose land they shed innocent blood. Judah will be inhabited forever, and Jerusalem through all generations. Again, one of the things that we've mentioned with Joel, he's very generic. There's not a lot of specifics. You finally get to the end of the book, and he mentions these different nations, and you still say, okay, can I try to put it into some historical context? But these are all historic enemies and adversaries of Israel, but never at the same time, right? So again, he's trying to be broad. But he's also giving a glimpse of how the Bible ends with the picture of the new heavens and the new earth and the new Jerusalem, where God will dwell and be with his people in an unbelievable picture. And then the final words of Joel, they're kind of curious, but so important. He says, their blood guilt, which I have not pardoned, I will pardon. The Lord dwells in Zion. Right? And Zion is that, again, not just Jerusalem, but that perfected picture of Jerusalem, the idealized picture of it. How does Joel begin the book? It begins, return to me, repent to me, call a sacred fast, mourn, understand your sins. Otherwise, you have to deal with my justice. And then God comes through, brings about justice, he says, but for my people, I'm going to offer pardon. I'm going to offer mercy. I'm going to offer grace. He says, this day will happen. We, as New Testament believers in Jesus, said that took place on the cross of Calvary through Jesus Christ. That's where our pardon came. And it wasn't just for God's people, the people of Israel, but for all people, for all nations, for everyone who calls on the name of the Lord. This, again, was where Peter went on that first sermon of the church. And then as after that, he brings pardon. He brings justice, or he brings pardon. But he says, for those he brings pardon, he gives them also his presence, the promise of his presence, eternal life with God and Creator in the perfect place. Now, here's one of the things about this book of Joel. Again, it's a powerful book. It's vivid, right? And this is the difference, say, between Joel and Bob Dylan. For Bob Dylan, Masters of War, it's just justice, right? It's just tit for tat, equal measure. For Joel the prophet, it's equal measure, but also pardon for those who will receive it. It's the gift, also the gift of mercy. And one of the things that you can get your whole mind caught up, and you can get in the idea with all the violence in the day of the Lord and get all these pictures and this imagery and you know, locusts and all these things that are thrown at you in Joel because it's such a powerful and vivid book. But at the end of the day, it's a passionate prophet of God who's trying to grab us by the scruff of our collars to shake us up. And he said, it's really, really simple. When it comes to God and trusting God, you can trust God to be a judge and to give you fairness and equity and just what your life demands, right? To reap exactly what you sowed. Or you can have a God who offers an incredible amount of mercy and pardon, and not just mercy, but a blessing beyond anything we can imagine in Jesus Christ. But the choice is yours. Do you want the judge? Do you want fairness? Or do you want eternal mercy and grace? The choice is up to yours. Call the worship team to close the service.